Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Since we finished the January-February issue of the hard copy of the Smithsonian Magazine, I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Smithsonian. So I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this storied Stradivarius violin, made in 1714, just sold for over $11 million at auction. By Sonia Anderson, it was published February 10th, 2025. A violin handcrafted in 1714 by Antonio Stradivari, the famous Italian luthier, has been sold for $11.25 million by the Boston's New England Conservatory, or NEC, at a Sotheby's auction. The music school will use the proceeds from the storied violin sale to create a new scholarship opportunity for students. After years of individual use by our students, now we can establish the largest named student scholarship program in the history of NEC, honoring our mission to educate and train the next generation of musicians, says Andrea Kalin, president of the New England Conservatory, in a statement from the auction house. While it has been a privilege to have one of the world's finest violins, this sale will be transformational for our students. The instrument, known as the Joachim Ma Stradivarius, is named for two of its most famous owners, violinist Joseph Joachim of Hungary and Si Han Ma of China. When Ma died in 2009, his estate gifted the violin to the New England Conservatory. Stradivari made this violin with maple and spruce woods and a rich red varnish during his golden period, the quality peak of his crafting career. Born around 1644 in Cremona, Italy, Stradivari began producing his own instruments when he was 22 years old. Though he made cellos and violas as well, his violin-making techniques were what made him famous. As Stradivari historian Toby Faber writes for Sotheby's, Stradivarius violins have no modern equivalents. Continuously coveted and played for over three centuries, they are without parallels in any other field of human endeavor. Joaquin bought the recently sold violin in the mid-19th century, when he was only 18 years old. The musician almost certainly played the instrument at the 1879 premiere of Johannes Brahms' Violin Concerto in D major, conducted by Brahms himself, per the statement. Simon Ganatra, chair of the strings department at Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music, tells the New York Times' Javier C. Hernandez that the violin's Joaquin connection adds major value. For a musician to play the instrument he once played is a magical experience and something you really cannot put a price on, Ganatra says. The instrument's other namesake, Ma, was not only a violinist and teacher, but the inventor of the Sihon Mute, an improved device for dampening a violin's sound which doesn't have to be removed when not in use. Born near Canton, China, in 1925, Ma immigrated to the United States and worked as a musician in New York for decades, performing on the Stradivarius, which he purchased with the proceeds from his invention. As Smithsonian Magazine's Ella Feldman reported last December, the Joaquin Ma was initially projected to fetch between $12 and $18 million, which would have made it the most expensive musical instrument ever auctioned. Its winning bid, $10 million from an anonymous buyer, $11.25 million with fees, fell short of the record. That still belongs to the Lady Blunt Stradivarius, which sold for $15.9 million in 2011. Kalin tells the Times that just four students of the New England Conservatory have used the Joachim Ma Stradivarius in the past decade, each for a year or two. Now we really have the chance to have it benefit so many more students, generations of students to come, she says. It's really about what's the most powerful use of the instrument. And that completes the article. The author, Sonia Anderson, is a writer and reporter based in Chicago. And her title was This Storied Stradivarius Violin, made in 1714, just sold for over $11 million at auction. This next title is An Enormous Branching String of Galaxy Clusters is the largest known structure in the universe, scientists say. The cosmic superstructure, Kuiper, is more than 13,000 times the length of the Milky Way, and its mass is 200 quadrillion times that of the Sun, according to preliminary research. It's by Margarita Bassi. It was published February the 11th, 2025. Meet Kuiper, a new contender for the largest known structure in the universe. It's essentially a giant cluster of galaxy clusters, stretching approximately 1.3 billion light-years long, more than 13,000 times the length of our Milky Way. It consists of 200 quadrillion solar masses. And if that weren't impressive enough, Kuiper has four other similar structures encompassing 30% of the galaxies, 45% of the galaxy clusters, 25% of the matter, and 13% of the overall volume of the known universe. These five superstructures were described in a preprint paper published on the server ARXIV last week. The paper has been accepted for publication in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics. The Kuiper superstructure, end to end, is slightly longer than the Sloan Great Wall. J. Richard Gott III, an astrophysicist at Princeton University who did not participate in the study, tells New Scientist Alex Wilkins. The Sloan Great Wall is another superstructure identified in 2003 by astronomers led by Gott. At the time of its discovery, it was the largest observed structure in the universe. Congratulations to them for finding it. The recent discovery came within the context of investigating the distribution of matter in the universe at different light wavelengths. The universe's expansion distorts light traveling from distant objects, increasing their wavelengths, and thus shifting them closer to the red part of the visible light spectrum. This phenomenon is called red shift, and the farther away an object is, the higher the red shift. The research team focused on matter within a little studied red shift region, officially between redshift 0.03 and 0.06. But how did they manage to zoom out enough to make out which cluster was part of which superstructure? Relying on data from the German ROSAT X-ray satellite, the team used a friends of friends algorithm that establishes a maximum distance between clusters for them to be considered part of the same structure, per New Scientist. In this way, the team identified the five superstructures within a range of approximately 425 million to 815 million light-years from Earth. the Shapley Supercluster, which at one time was considered the largest superstructure in the local universe, the Serpens Corona Borealis superstructure, the Hercules superstructure, the Sculptor Pegasus superstructure, and, of course, Quipu, which researchers named after the Incan technique of recording numbers with knots on string. In Quipu, there is one main strand of clusters of galaxies from which many strands depart. Astrophysicist Alfredo Carpinetti writes in IFL Science, "Beyond the fact that its record-breaking size might soon be challenged, it's unclear whether the matter included within Quipu is bound together by gravity," says Seshadri Nadathur, a cosmologist at the University of Portsmouth in England, who was not involved in the study, to New Scientist. "Hence, as the universe expands, some of these galaxies may drift apart from each other instead of collapsing in on themselves, in which case, according to some interpretations, it's not really a bound structure," he adds. Either way, in addition to the inherent excitement of getting to study the largest things ever, analyzing superstructures such as Quipu has practical applications for our understanding of the greater universe. For example, superstructures can bend light in a phenomenon called gravitational lensing, distort our measurements of the universe's expansion, and impact the cosmic microwave background, a type of radiation scientists depend on to study the Big Bang. As the cosmos evolves, Quipu and other described superstructures might eventually pull apart into several collapsing units, the researchers write in the preprint. As a result, these structures are transient. But, the team adds, at present they are special physical entities with characteristic properties and special cosmic environments deserving special attention. That ends the article. The title was "An Enormous Branching String of Galaxy Clusters is the Largest Known Structure in the Universe, Scientists Say," by Daily Correspondent Margarita Bassi. Sonia Anderson also writes the next article. Experts say they found a portrait of a mysterious businessman hidden beneath a Titian masterpiece. When the Renaissance artist painted his famous Ecce Homo around 1570, he covered up a portrait of an unknown professional man standing at a desk. Beneath the famous Titian painting, researchers have uncovered a portrait of an unknown professional man. The never-before-seen piece has been hidden behind the Italian Renaissance artist's Ecce Homo since roughly 1570. Now a rendering of the mysterious portrait is on display in Cyprus. Experts from the Cyprus Institute made the discovery while preparing the piece for conservation work. When they examined it under a microscope, they noticed odd colors showing through the painting's crequilure, the web of fine cracks that forms on an oil painting over many years. A preliminary X-ray performed in the Institute's Andreas Pittas Art Characterization Laboratories, or APAC Labs, revealed an underpainting, according to a statement. Researchers then used advanced imaging techniques to reveal the complete portrait, which was painted upside down beneath Ecce Homo. It was like uncovering a puzzle, Nicolas Bicatiz, director of APAC Labs, tells Reuters' Michelle Combus. "Once we started realizing that there was a complete work underneath, we became extremely excited. We started looking into the layers, using a range of imaging methods, and then at the same time physical, chemical, and analytical methods that allowed us to look under the surface." Ecce Homo, also known as Christ Shown to the People, depicts the Roman governor Pontius Pilate presenting Christ to the people, who will decide his fate. Christian iconography was a common theme for Titian, who's known as Venice's greatest 16th-century painter. Titian reused canvases, a practice that isn't uncommon in fine art. Researchers knew that Titian sometimes painted over partially finished pieces, but this case is unique because the underpainting is a completed portrait. According to the statement, the researchers hoped to get a better understanding of Titian's artistic strategies and how the underpainting might have influenced Ecce Homo. The portrait that is beneath this painting is the portrait of a standing man. We have not been able to identify who this man is. He's not one of the known patrons, for example, or friends or clients of Titian. Beckertiz notes that the man appears professional. The portrait is set in an office, with its subject standing in front of a desk, touching a book or stack of papers with one hand and holding a quill in the other. This is clearly the portrait of a banker, a lawyer, some professional man in his workplace, he adds. Titian turned the man's portrait upside down before painting over it, and he thinks the artist then integrated elements of the first portrait into Ecce Homo. We found that parts of the facial characteristics, the contours of the man's face, for example, part of his jawline, follow the painting execution of the ropes tying Christ's hands, Beckertiz tells Art Nurse Adam Schrader. There are some other details in the background space and room represented in the portrait which also facilitate the drawing of the Ecce Homo composition. Using the X-ray images, experts also recreated the hidden portrait. Their oil painting is now on display alongside Ecce Homo at the Municipal Arts Center in Limassol, near the island nation's southern coast. That completes the article. The title, Experts Say They Found a Portrait of a Mysterious Businessman Hidden Beneath a Titian Masterpiece, by Sonia Anderson. This next title is, on this day in 1964, 73 million Americans tuned in to watch the biggest act in music, by Sarah Holzman. 1 hour, 5 songs, 73 million viewers. That's what it took to cement the Beatles in the hearts of Americans and create one of the most iconic moments in television history. On February 9, 1964, John, Paul, George, and Ringo achieved just this during their debut performance on The Ed Sullivan Show. The Beatles had formed 4 years prior, with John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr emerging from Liverpool, England, ready to take the international stage. The Fab Four gained acclaim touring clubs around Europe, and by 1962, their single, Love Me Do, made them global heartthrobs. Their first two studio albums, Please Please Me and With the Beatles, put the band on top of the world and the charts. During the Beatles' first 4 years as a group, they stayed on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, courting American listeners through the radio. But Ed Sullivan had a plan. The TV executive, the force behind a self-titled Sunday night variety show, had sent a scout to Europe looking for upcoming talent, and the Beatles seemed to fit the bill. Booker Jack Babb connected with the band's manager, Brian Epstein, and the pair spun a story fit for a primetime audience. Epstein sold the foursome based on their youthful good looks and a royal appearance. He billed them as the first long-haired boys to perform at the invitation of Elizabeth II, referring to a recent performance for the Queen's sister, Princess Margaret. The Beatles were already immensely popular with American teenagers, and the days before their The Ed Sullivan Show appearance created more fanfare for the band. Their single, I Want to Hold Your Hand, leaked in the United States early and quickly topped the charts. Tickets for their upcoming appearance were nearly impossible to come by, and lucky guests prepared by purchasing wigs to match the band's signature shags. At 8 p.m., 73 million people tuned in to CBS to see the Beatles' debut. Accompanied by ear-piercing screams, the band kicked things off with All My Lovin', a song written by Mr. McCartney for their second album. They quickly followed up with Till There Was You and She Loves You. Other acts, including impressionist Frank Gorshin and Broadway's Georgia Brown, then took the stage before the Beatles wrapped the show with I Saw Her Standing There and I Want to Hold Your Hand. The debut episode was a television hit. Its 73 million viewers represented more than 60% of all television viewers in the U.S. that evening. The episode instantly became the most watched TV event of its time. The aftermath brought more mind-boggling popularity for the Liverpool lads and a turning point for rock and roll. The Beatles catered to their audience, masses of teenage girls now empowered as listeners and music trendsetters for the first time. Their buy-in to John, Paul, George, and Ringo that night on The Ed Sullivan Show thrust the Beatles further on their way to critical success. 12 studio albums and an enduring legacy as one of the world's most popular and pioneering acts. And that's the end of the article. The title was, On This Day in 1964, 73 Million Americans Tuned In to Watch the Biggest Act in Music, by Sarah Holzman. The last article today is Party Animal, by Ted Scheinman. When Martin Van Buren arrived in Washington to be sworn in as a senator in 1821, he told a friend he planned to build up a party for himself. It was an odd time to be party-mongering, and Van Buren an unlikely party-monger. Republican James Monroe had run unopposed in the 1820 presidential election, and every politician in Washington, with varying degrees of enthusiasm, was calling himself a Republican, writes James M. Bradley in Martin Van Buren, America's First Politician, a lively and illuminating new biography on our eighth president, the first to be born a U.S. citizen. Absent a strong opposition party, Van Buren lamented that politicians were appealing less to ideals and more to personalities, and wished, as he put it in an 1827 letter, to unite citizens through party principle rather than personal preference. Born in 1782 to a tavern-keeping family in Kinderhook, New York, Van Buren had little schooling but made himself a lawyer, rising to the heights of power despite his lack of military experience or strong family ties to ensure patronage. At 5'6", he was considered notably short, and friends and foes called him the Little Magician for his outsized political talents. He proceeded swiftly from senator to secretary of state, vice president, and president. And though he failed to win a second term, Bradley says, he built and designed the party system that defined how politics was practiced and power wielded in the United States. We are living in the world Van Buren created. In the first decades of the Republic, leaders had generally called themselves Federalists or Republicans, but few imagined that parties would be a permanent feature of the nation's political life, Bradley writes. They expected parties to disband once the Republic was more secure and its great issues settled. Van Buren plowed ahead with a thoroughly modern view that parties were not a regrettable necessity, but a revolutionary means of achieving and using power. With Andrew Jackson, he co-founded the Democratic Party in 1828, cannily banking on Jackson's personal appeal to win that year's election. Van Buren became Jackson's vice president, and the Democrats dominated politics until 1860. He didn't think that politics should be a hobby for gentlemen to practice in their spare time, Bradley says. A party had to have an organization, a structure, a personality, and it should be run by professionals. As early as 1819, Van Buren had called slavery a moral evil, but he appeased its partisans frequently. There was a dark side to Van Buren's ascendancy, Bradley writes. The Democratic Party became a vehicle for the expansion of slavery, the forced expulsion and dispossession of native peoples from the eastern United States, and imperial conquest of the West. Indeed, Van Buren helped professionalize the use of race in different and effective ways as a wedge issue in elections and political debates. Bradley says these practices are still very prevalent today. The main difference? Van Buren never could have conceived of a party system where big money plays such an enormous role. Still, Bradley says, in many ways, today's politicians are using Van Buren's playbook. That completes the article, and that also completes the broadcast today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I've been reading articles from the online edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs there. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.